Blog Talk Radio.
Yvonne, call in. Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and I am sorry for the technical difficulties. I am hoping that we're going to be able to connect right now with Yvonne Smith and Late Night for Late Night with a Hero.
Hello? I'm sorry, but I've been having some trouble. I'm trying to get in. Jen, are you there? Jen Constantine?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm so sorry. I've been having trouble getting in. I'm not able to get in. We had a little technical difficulty. Thank you for joining us. This is Late Night with a Hero. And this is the Healing Voices, the movie Impressions and Call-Ins. And I want to thank Jen Constantine for agreeing to come on. I was trying to get Dan, who was in the film as well. We're talking about tonight Healing Voices, the movie. And Jen, thank you for calling from South Dakota. Even though we got in a little late, I have to tell you that the movie had a tremendous impression on people here in Washington, D.C. It was shown here in our psychiatric hospital. And although it was not a full house, the people who were there were some from the community and some from people who actually were residents in the hospital. And I'm going to have to tell you that you had a tremendous impression on the people who were in the hospital at St. Elizabeth's, which is a state psychiatric hospital in Washington, D.C. And, in fact, I was up there today because we have our annual Friends and Family Day. And people were coming up to me, and they were talking about you and a lot about I'm forgetting her name now, but the Mind Freedom woman there. And so they were very impressed on the
Celia Brown, probably, right?
Yeah, Celia Brown, they were very impressed because where I live in Washington, D.C., which is the bedroom of the psychiatric hospital, we have about 97% of the people in there African-American, and they very rarely see people who have lived experience that are successful. So I'm very happy that you're on the line to talk to us tonight, and I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved with the movie in the first place? How did you come to be in the movie?
Oryx was our working for the National Empowerment Center, and so they were our technical assistance center for our state, and getting our peer-run organization kind of up and running here in South Dakota. So I work for the only peer-run organization in the state, so we kind of do it all. And so I was connected with Oryx through work, basically. And then we actually had PJ come out here. We got some small grant funding to do some video projects for young people. And so Oryx connected us with PJ so that he could come out and teach folks how to create a video. And then we used dialogue. He actually came out, I think, one or two more times after that, but we used dialogue, and people with lived experience made these YouTube videos, and they learned about how to kind of plan out what to do as far as what kind of video you want to make, what kind of impact you want to have, what you think your audience is going to be, and then go all the way through filming and editing and production. And so folks that attended these workshops, these video workshops, learned how to create a video from start to finish, and then those videos went up on the South Dakota United YouTube site. And so I met PJ through that, and they were talking about this film that they were doing then, and I think part of their asking me to be in it was that they'd been looking at folks to be in the video who were either on the East Coast or some on the West Coast. And so I think through working in South Dakota, their eyes were really kind of open to the fact that there's this whole middle part of the country that has some unique challenges and also some unique opportunities. And I think that they wanted that to be a piece of the film as well, so that it could be more well-rounded. And I really appreciate you sharing the impact that the screening had there in D.C., which is awesome to see. And I know people of color are horribly underrepresented in this movement in general. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. I know it's much tougher to crawl out of poverty the other difficulties that you can have that end you up in the system when you're a person of color, that makes things much more difficult. And I'd love to find ways to connect and pull more people out.
I've had this thing. I've gone to myself. I've flown out to Idaho and places like that. And because of the in the past of the marvelous things of the internet, people in the past before Facebook, They may not have seen a picture of a person, so they didn't know exactly what a person looked like. But
yes.
I'm just telling you that you have had tremendous impact. Our state hospital, only certain people could come to the filming of the film because in order the auditorium that they have it in, although it's in the hospital, it's considered to be in the community, and so people have to have privileges to get there.
Right.
But there are certain people that do things so that they can have opportunities to know about things in that movement, whether it's printing stuff out and slipping it in, or whether it's putting stuff on a USB so they can listen to things like our blog radio. There's underground, and even people that listen to this that know this, where they're in a state hospital, if they had the same situation, it's, you know, you copy stuff to a USB where people have a what do you call it, a headset so they can listen to it so they can see what's going on. A lot of times, even state hospitals, they try to, or at least where I am, they try to keep things sheltered from the people. So
right.
I'm just telling you, Jen, that you are very inspirational, and I had sent you some questions because many of the people who were in the hospital, they had questions about what your performance on the film, because they noticed you had your two little daughters with you. Daughter and your son, but that tears them up, especially the little girl who was very... Your daughter, who was very much independent, but she said, "Oh yes, she sometimes gets along with her other sibling, but sometimes not." And the loving care. A lot of people don't realize we make great parents.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I'm certainly not anywhere near the only one. I know, I almost think that in a lot of ways that we make better parents. Especially if our kids fall outside the norm a little bit.
Yeah.
From what I see, we're more loving and open to kids that are different. A bit more protective and making sure that our kids feel loved, and making sure that they know that they can talk to us about anything and that we'll be there for them.
Well, I came on the show late, and I'm sorry because I don't know what happened, but I was having some technical difficulty, but I wanted to tell people, if they're calling in, they have two ways to call in. They can call in 267-521-0167. And if you don't have a pencil and paper, go get pencil and paper now, because I will repeat this several times. And if you're calling outside the continental U.S., like you're calling from Canada, Alaska. Alaska's the U.S., but Hawaii, or you're calling from the United Kingdom, we have an 800 number, and that 800 number is 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. And you want to press 1 or star 1 to let us know that you want to come in and make a comment or ask a question. Now, let me ask you this, Jen. How did you, I understand that the film was about healing voices. Do you actually hear voices?
Constantly. Yeah, that's a little bit, that's a simplified version of what I experienced. But yeah, I am a plethora of things that other people can't perceive. I'm handling daily, regularly. So I'm fairly adept at navigating that because it's been a lot of years. But yeah, all the time.
And you might be able to help because when I was up at our annual Friends and Family Day, I guess I'm a bad person. I'm really bad because I've had this to happen to me several times. This is why I'm sure that I can't work any place because I am they're afraid that I'm a Harriet Tubman. But I oftentimes tell people, because some people have a relationship with angels or with God, and I tell them, your therapist, your psychiatrist, they don't understand about that. Don't talk to them about it. Talk to the chaplain or write something down about that, because they're not going to understand what you're talking about. And to be truthful, I don't hear voices. I tell people many times, and I might be wrong in doing this, Jen. You can tell me this. I say, your voices might not go away. They might get tapped down, but they'll keep giving you medication until your teeth fall out, until you have arthritis and other conditions. So,
that's certainly been my experience. And they were able to dumb down my voices and my visions and, altered sense of smells and perceiving things that weren't there. They were able to dumb that down a lot with drugs, and the more drugs I was on, the more it was dumbed down. But it also dumbed all the rest of me down to the point where I couldn't function, I couldn't read, I could barely get up off the couch. It really took all of me away from me, and it took a long time to even start to gain that back. And especially continuing to be in a system that was teaching me that that was the best that I could hope for, and that the most important thing was that I wasn't experiencing anything abnormal.
I think that is done because even though I wasn't acknowledging that I was a voice hearer, I was experiencing the same thing, is that whatever I was experiencing, they could not seem to be seeing it as something, as an expression of normal pain that I was having. That was the thing that was occurring, is they could not believe that, and so therefore they medicated me to death.
Right, right. And I think they're taught not to acknowledge that pain as well. They're taught that pain is irrelevant, and that you need to what they're focused on is your behavior, and that it's irrelevant the amount of pain that you've been in. I think they're taught a real lack of compassion in the industry for the most part. And they're taught to stay away from those issues when someone brings up trying to deal with some heavy stuff or having trauma or having difficulty with big life problems. They're taught that that's kind of not important. What's important is to medicate to get a person. So I fully agree with you, Yvonne, there as far as what I've experienced and also what I hear from a lot of folks. I talk to hundreds of people a year sharing those similar experiences, and that they really just want to know, do you hear voices, or is there some other behavior that we can label, that we can decide is important, but they don't really want to know about your history or what might have brought you to the space that you're in, beyond the fact that you have symptoms to label. And so that's really common.
They don't want to know what caused it. It could be trauma. It could be that because of the way that you interpret what's happened to you, you know, somebody else would say they have racing thoughts, but they don't listen to that. They don't listen to what.
Yeah, absolutely. They don't investigate where that might be coming from. Mm-hmm. Or what kind of chaos might be going on in that person's world. Definitely. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's part of what the film really tries to address, is that maybe that's the kind of stuff that we should be looking at a little more. And I think there's a fear too that's kind of ingrained into what providers are taught. That if they ask you too much about why you might be experiencing those things, that's going to make it worse. And I know the film addresses that specifically with voices, being taught not to collude with the patient, not to talk about what the voices are saying. That's a line in one of the scenes. And I think that happens across the board with these kinds of behaviors, is that there's a real fear that people are going to get worse if there's a space for them to speak more about where they are, in relation to what's happened to them.
Well, can I ask you this question, and you can tell us anything if you don't feel comfortable walking with. How did you come into the mental health system?
The first, I guess my first experience is I was pretty young. I was talking about some of my visions and voices with my mom from the age of maybe 4 that she recalls. As I started to have more and more social problems, by the time I was in 3rd grade, they were pulling me out of school to go to the school counselor, which really helps with social problems, by the way, when kids can know that you're getting pulled out of school to go to the shrink, that just makes you even more of an outcast. So, not that I mind it necessarily, but so that was like kind of my first experience.
You were in 3rd grade, you were like 8 and 9 years old, right?
Yeah. And so I was the abnormal one. So I went to the school counselor I got out of some of my classes to go to the school counselor. And then my mom also tried psychologists and counselors outside of that, school system, who had some great ideas, like, put your kid in the girls club for the summer. So I learned how to, you know, try to fight or get beaten down by gangs at the girls club. That was a good summer experience. I think I was 13, 12 or 13, the first time my mom took me to a psychiatrist. And so he did prescribe a limited amount of drugs, ended up in the psych ward for the first time at 15. Then when I turned 18, I was out of the system for probably 4 or 5 years. I tossed my gear in the back of somebody's car and moved to Minneapolis for about 1.5 years. And then probably it was another year back around home before I got put in the psych hospital and then the state hospital for the first time there. And then several times over the next 10 years in the psych hospital and the state hospital. And then also the rest of that time pretty much sentenced to the community mental health center, which here at the time was done through coercion.
Let me ask you this. If you were writing a letter to yourself or to your mother, when you were going through all of that, what would you have said? What would have worked better?
I honestly don't think I'd go back and change anything. Not like it was enjoyable or fun necessarily, but I had a lot of good times in the woods. I had a deep spiritual connection to the Black Hills here. Met a lot of really interesting and memorable entities, that some of whom I still hang out with. I don't think that I would go back and change anything about the way that I lived. I think that what I've been through up until this moment has all been important and was meant to play out the way it did. And I feel like that was a hard-fought battle to get me to this place where I am right now today. And even though it's going to probably continue to be a hard-fought battle to get me to where I'll be tomorrow and the next day and the next year and 10 years down the road, I don't feel like I would have some kind of higher ability to choose better how my life plays out. I think it's meant to play out the way it does. So
mm-hmm. There's nothing that would have helped you or made it easier for you?
There probably are things that would have helped me, and definitely in my later adult years, when I was more deeply entrenched in the system, I feel really lucky and blessed that I was shielded from psychiatry, and that I grew up in an age that was a little bit pre-Ritalin and pre-heavy diagnosis on kids. I think that saved me in a lot of ways.
But you said something about it was a little bit shielded?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was shielded from a deeper... I think if I would have been born 10 years later, I would have been put much more graphically into the mental health system much earlier, at a younger age. The drugging wasn't as massive and as common as it is today, or even 10 years ago. So I grew up in I was having these kinds of issues in the early 80s, well, in the 80s in general, late 70s or 80s. So I was growing up in an age that predated kind of this whole let's diagnose and drug every child who we can catch, who doesn't quite fit.
The thing many people said about the film that you were in was they just love the love between yourself and your significant other, your husband, and your children, especially the little girl. You can tell your little daughter that she made a great impression.
She's a
She had a mind of her own.
Oh yeah, yeah. She certainly does that, and I think that's another great thing about being able to be a parent who grew up different. My daughter's pretty different too. She's bright and high energy and has a strong social conscience. My son does too, but he's more the diplomat. And so she's the kind of kid that could pick up a label really easy and really early, and also have a lot of problems if she was living in a house with parents who didn't understand.
She seems like a person who could be president of the United States.
And I tell her all the time that how she is will serve her much better when she's grown up. It's kind of tough when you're a kid and you're pretty intelligent and fairly well convinced that you know it all, and definitely going to call everyone on anything that they do that's not well aligned with social justice or morality. So
at all, I could see her going in, no matter where she was, running the show, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. She's that kind of kid. And my son, they're a minute apart. They're twins, and mm-hmm. polar opposites. So he's very gentle, very compassionate. He notices whenever people are hurting, or if there's a kid on the playground that is on their own, he's the one to go over and introduce himself and try to make that kid more comfortable. So they both have these special ways of being in the world. And I think one of the great things about being like kind of a movement mom is that I can stick up for them and protect them from a school system and from teachers that may not understand or that may get frustrated with them if they don't learn the way the teachers are teaching.
Well, it may not have been, I picked up on it, but it seems as though that you and your husband or their father, that you were very patient.
Yeah, he is my husband.
And your husband was sort of like, seemed like he knew that this was a lot of work.
He does know that, for sure.
We talked about having children, but we didn't know this was going to be all of this.
they're a handful, and that's a whole other layer there.
You know, when I started doing my recovery work maybe 20 years ago, and I was asking people, and at that time there was hardly anybody doing it. That's like back in 96, 97. Many people just told me that what they wanted to do was they wanted to procreate. They wanted to be parents. And they just thought they could be very loving parents. I mean, this is what I asked, and overwhelming. It was like the number one or number two answer. That people wanted to be parents. And then they felt as though they could be loving parents. And they could be a better parent than their parent was to them. It was so overwhelming. This was, like I said, this was like in 95, 96, 97. This was the overwhelming amount of people that were saying this, that they wanted to be a parent and they could be great at it. So it seems as though that you and your husband have been great parents. I asked my daughter, son, and niece. I asked them because we've had some things to come up in my community about corporal punishment. I said, well, was I really bad? I mean, and the only thing they told me was, no, you didn't whomp us a lot. The ones that you had were memorable. And because I was in an environment where I grew up where we got a lot of corporal punishment, I kind of relaxed off of that. And I just noticed the kind of love between you and your daughter. I mean, it was very endearing.
Thanks.
That she really cared for. And a lot of times when we have gone through a lot of trauma, we don't necessarily have that where a person is endearing to us. That they really see that there are things that are going on and we may not necessarily see what's happening to us. So I just want to thank you for portraying that on film, because we oftentimes do this, but we don't oftentimes see it.
Right.
And there is, because I have something wherein in Massachusetts, I'm in Washington, D.C., where there are people that are actually, and in fact, I'm sharing this website with the call with other people while we're talking, but people don't actually see that people are actually being kind, and that there are children out here, and they're hurting,
mm-hmm.
and they don't know this. And the parents are doing what I say is what I was doing. My parents did what their parents did to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. We have to help heal these children so that they can know that we love them.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're doing is we want to protect them, and all the time it is not about protection. But we want to protect them and make sure that they're doing okay.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I think that we don't, you're right, we don't, like there isn't a great connotation in general with anybody that is labeled with a serious mental illness. There isn't a great connotation with those folks in general of being able to do anything worthwhile. There's that whole idea that the media created and fear-mongered, pushed idea that we're violent when actually we're no more inclined to violence and actually 14 times more likely to be victims of violence. And I think that there are statistics about the number of people who wouldn't allow a person labeled with schizophrenia to be around their children or to watch their children. So obviously there's
ridiculous,
these ideas.
Ridiculous.
In society that we're somehow dangerous or we can't care for our children. But I'll tell you this, I know a lot of parents who aren't labeled. And I don't know that we're certainly not perfect parents, my husband and I, but I will tell you that our children know that we love them no matter what they do. There's never anything that they could ever do that could make us love them any less. They know that they can talk to us about anything throughout their whole lives, and that they can come to us with whatever it is, and that they're going to be heard and that they're going to be listened to. They know that it's not okay for anyone to touch them in a violent way or in a way that makes them uncomfortable, and they know that they will be heard if they come talk to us and tell us about that. They know they're learning a little at a time about their bodies changing from kids into adults. And I mean, I think the most important thing is that they know that they're loved. They know when we discipline because of to keep them safe or to help them to grow up to be the best adults that they can be, to help them grow up to be the most loving adults that they can be. So those are the only two reasons that we discipline. They know that, and they know that we do it out of love. We talk to them, we're respectful of them. And I think that that's pretty rare in American families across the board. And mm-hmm. I would guess that it's not nearly as rare with parents who have lived experience of diagnostic labeling. So,
well, you know, something is that we have to learn that what has happened to us from the fallout for the mental health system is not necessarily what will be helpful to producing well-adjusted children. And I think that's what it is that we've had negative experiences in our lives as young people, and those experiences may not help us to become very good adults. And I think that what you're saying is a very, very true statement, is that we can be very loving parents. Most of the people that I've met that had experiences I've had, they have been very kind. Even I've met people who they themselves were the product of parents who've had some experiences. And these are some, in fact, in my village where I live, we have about 70,000 people, and there's one guy. He is the best father in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he's more like you and your husband than anything else. And he was saying to me, he didn't realize we had all these activities up at the state hospital. But his
mm-hmm.
mother had been at the state hospital, and he had not known these things. And he is the best father. He goes by handle on Facebook as, I'm not trying to say what it was. I'm not going to say it because he may not want it. But he's in a very high position in our city government.
Uh-huh.
And he's the best father there is. He always posts things about himself and his children. And he's very kind. He's never irritable about his kids. He shares it with us when his kids are demanding a lot of his time. And he will say, like, during Christmas and Thanksgiving, oh, we're staying up so late, and I can't believe it. And he has the patience of, just the patience of Job. And he just enjoys his fatherhood so much. And I know not only him who has a parent who, parent like us, but other people who have had children. They just are so patient. We are so loving to these children when we realize that what has happened to us does not have to reflect upon the children we brought here. I have to say this about my daughter. I feel like I was considering all the things that happened to me, that I was an excellent parent, that I did not let all those things come into there. And that was the tenderness that I saw in the film with you and your daughter and your son and your spouse, that you had this tenderness that was there. I wish that Jen was here, and I hope that if he is listening, that he would call in to our phone number, because I think a lot of people would like to hear from him. Dan, I'm sorry, not Jen, but Dan, our guest call in is 267-521-0167. And if you don't have the access to call on the phone, you can call this number, 855-346-3551. And that is our toll-free number.
Yvonne? It's 855-346-3351. And you do have a caller from 310 area code, so I'm going to open the line. I'm not sure if this person wants to speak or not, so just give it a second. Let's see.
I think this person told me that they were getting feedback, and because I had let them in a couple of times, and they said, no, they didn't want to get in. Thank you. That is Jen. That's a producer. That's Lauren from New York. She's a producer. She's the person who was responsible for having this show. I know that Celia has said that she would come in and out of the show, but evidently we're having some feedback. I was trying to see if I could go in on the phone, but that is the person that we're having. Now, when you did the film, Jen, did you know the whole compilation, or was it just in pieces?
I'm sorry, what was that? I missed the question a little bit there.
In other words, when the film was being made, the Healing Voices, did you know about the totality of the film, or did you just know about pieces, or did they just come in film? How did that come about?
Well, I was talking to PJ and Oryx about the film before they asked me to participate, and so I knew what their vision was and what they were trying to do with the film a little bit, and then knew a little bit of the background on some of the stuff as well. And then I did offer to help them some with editing at different points, and help them with some of the social media pieces and volunteered at different steps along the way. So I was fairly well aware as the film was coming together, what that was looking like, and the whole reason for my participating, because I'm normally a really private person and I'm not big on cameras, even picture wise. The organization that I work for, I'm not in very many of the pictures. I tend to find ways to sneak out. So it's definitely not a super comfortable thing for me to be in a film. But I really believed in the vision that that Oryx and PJ had and in what they were wanting to do. And I felt like they had the capacity to do it in a way that was going to create change. I'm all for things that make people feel better, ranting and raving and protests and having your voice heard. And there's definitely a place for that. At the same time, there's not very many people listen when there's screaming and yelling and ranting and raving. And so their idea about doing a film that was really meant to change the conversation, I felt like was something that was vitally important, and that I was willing to go on camera and open up pieces of my life to take part in really creating something that would move people to change. I think that's something that's absolutely needed.
That's very true that sometimes there's a time for jumping up and down and screaming and being an activist, and there's also a time to have people listen and maybe make changes to whatever they're doing. So I hear you there, because I've been the holler and the screaming myself. And basically for me, and people listening, is that when you're doing that, you're trying to knock in so that you can get in, so people can hear what you're saying, and that you not only just holler and scream, but you have something to say and some alternatives. It's not good enough just to get up and holler and scream, but to say, look, I'm knocking down the door, and we know what the problem is, and I have some solutions. I want you to listen to me and consider those solutions.
Right.
And I think that is sometimes what gets lost, is that when you knock the door down, what is going to be the result? You may be heard, but when you're heard, you want to say, what is it that you can say that should be changed, or what is the solution? Everybody knows the problems, but many of us don't have any idea of a solution for what is going on. And I think that people like South Dakota United, is that the organization that you have, South Dakota United?
The organization that I work for, is South Dakota United for Hope and Recovery. And I've worked with them since 2008.
Mm-hmm. And you're still working for them, right?
Yeah, currently, yes.
When I had sent you some stuff, and I didn't know what in the world was going on, and I hope that Celia Brown is on the line now. I hope that she can come in.
Hi, Yvonne.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing okay, and I have to tell you, it had a tremendous effect on people. When I was at the Friends and Family Day, because of some of the things that I can't tell you on the line of what we do to get information to people, because they don't have access to the internet, but people were bowled over that you were in that film.
Oh, wow. You know,
you were like, if you came there would be a ticker tape parade.
Oh, my God. Wow, thank you. I didn't really know the impact.
People knew your name and knew David Oakes' name.
Wow.
Even though they're kept very cloistered, they don't really have access to the internet other than when they go to the computer lab.
Mm-hmm.
They did. I mean, it was a very small audience, but people do know who Mind Freedom is. So you had a very powerful impact. And the fact that also there was only, you were the only African-American person in that film, and it was a venue where 97% of the people in St. Elizabeth and in the community where I live are African-American. So they were very excited about the fact that you were
Well, I want to tell you that that's a clip of a larger video of that they did. They just took a clip out of it. You can the full length of, you know, my story is on YouTube under the Open Paradigm Project. So it's more than that. It's just the show.
You need to tell me this, because they don't have access to the internet. And what I do is, for some people, I it's like Cuba. I don't know what you know about what happens in Cuba. In Cuba, they don't have access to the internet, but they copy things on a hard drive and they take it around.
Right.
But we have a similar situation there where somehow, some mysterious way, copies of things in printed matter find their way to people. And in some way, some things get found some mysterious way on little USB things where people can listen to. It's a way. And I know people
I could send you the link, Yvonne. That's the best I could do, because I don't have a hard copy of it. It's just on YouTube.
You send me the link, so somehow mysteriously these things will get there, because as I said, it's hard for people to understand that, as I was saying when we had the film showing Friday night, and Debbie Plotnick was there, and Daphne I was telling them, I said, you know, it's really, this was just before people started milling in, I said, it's really mysterious that people would even know about our movement, you know. So it's just really heartfelt that they would know whatever was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So we just, you know, by mystery, things do occur and people do find out about what is happening. And I want to thank you for you and Jen both for being in the film, because it's a big thing. I don't know how Orange had told me, because I invited him on. And he was in Canada at another showing. Because I would ask him, how would people be able to see the film, whether it would be after this, how they could get this film available to them.
Well, I think you should send him, I don't know if you have his email, and I think they're thinking about that. I do have it to more people.
We had changing hands here, and I was asking that people do need to know about how they can get access to the film. And they need
I think it's important.
They need to have access, like it was a, they need to have access so they can teach the staff and other people about, you know, the healing voices. I think that for several years I had been talking about the Healing Voices Network, but it was like not seen very much.
Well, I mean, for 5 or 6 years, I remember they were raising money to do the film through Kickstarter and, you know, other funding sites.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually amazed that they put this all together, and it took a long time to do.
Anyway, that's what people have to know, that, you know, this is not about anything other than being able to be available, because we can say different things that we want to say about this happening, but it all has to do with money.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the money to do it, to distribute, and I think Orange Cohen has done a great job in being able to, and while you hear the noises, because I'm clicking on, we have a small live audience that hears our show. There is maybe about 100 times the number of people who hear a show who actually see it through podcasts. So if we have maybe 10 people on the show, we may have 20 to 30 or 40 people who listen to it through podcasts. So,
well, one of the things that I think they're thinking about is how to continue the discussion. So I think that they're going to be showing this more, you know, in our local, you know, grassroots community, you know.
Yeah, I think that's great for people to see this, and especially in the environment that we're in now. I don't know. I hope that Jen is still on the line. Jen, are you still there?
Yeah, I am. I was actually just fixing to pop out for a minute. I did want to say to Celia how much I appreciated your voice in the film, and also the longer version on the Open Paradigm Project YouTube site. I also wanted to mention to you, Yvonne, that Open Paradigm Project, if you just search for the Open Paradigm Project on YouTube, their page has Celia's video along with dozens of other movement leaders, and the Leonard Roy Frank is on there. There's a bunch of great videos and people telling their stories on there that could be very impactful. So that's definitely something to share. And I think probably you could download it on a flash drive from YouTube, I would guess, although I don't know too much about how that works.
MP3 player, because I'm telling you that there are pockets of places where our message of what's going on is very welcome. It's like, when I was told today, it was like, Cecilia, I was told by one person who I consider a political prisoner, it was like water in the desert. It was like water in the desert. I mean, if you could imagine someone saying that to you, it's like they were dry parched, and that was like water in the desert. I could not, even Friday night, I had to cry because I had someone come up to me. They said it out loud, and other people were there, but they came to me and says, "Get me out of here. Get me out of here." And there was nothing I could do, nothing I could say, except for to refer them to the organizations who are supposed to be taking care of them. And, came home and I cried.
Yeah.
There was nothing, virtually nothing. I says I could do that, And we even had 2 weeks ago, Mary Ellen Copeland and another person had come to the hospital, and I felt so sorry for Mary Ellen, because she had insisted, I think it was because I had said this, was that because she was coming to do ground rounds, is to make sure that you insist on meeting with the patients. And people were coming up to her saying, there was two men, not women, and that they were sexually abused or physically abused.
Well, you know, it was good that Mary Ellen, you know, you had a forum there, because a lot of still full in, you know, in the psych hospital, they're not able to express what they really feel. And it probably gave them some kind of, quote, permission to say, look, I got sexually abused, or, you know, this is not a regular thing that happens in the hospital. Just,
well, some of them were, like, basically silent. We have a patient government. And myself and Francis Priest, it started maybe over 10 years ago. But it was just like, it was like, you know, I keep going up there. I will go to the hospital at least 3 times a month because it's in my neighborhood. And it's like, you know, you feel so helpless to them. And for them to see the film, to see, mm-hmm. I mean, especially Cecilia, you don't imagine. For some of these people to see an African American woman boldly up there, to see Jen, to see a person who was a family member, who you had 2 children and you were loving toward them, you know, that kind of seeing that, what that could do for people. And not only that, even though there was not many people because, like I said, the auditorium is not in an area. Its auditorium is an area which is considered to be the public space.
Mm.
But the word spreads. You know, the word spreads.
Yeah. I want to say, Jen, I really loved Judith Cecilia in the film. I think you really told your story, the pain and everything you've gone through. And had the screening at New York City at Baruch College, so we had like 140 people, and they were a mixture of clinicians, of survivors, peers, family members. It was interesting. But, you know, I think people were able to look at the film and sit with it. It was a lot of things, I'm sure, the people we're not comfortable hearing, you know, our experiences and stuff, but it was amazing that they sat through it. And I really want to really give kudos to Oryx and PJ. I think they did a great job in framing what the issues are, you know?
I think that's wonderful. And Lauren, are you still there?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Jen. Hi, Yvonne. Hi, Celia. Hi, everybody listening. I guess I wanted to say a couple of things, if I could, really quickly. And I just want to say to Jen and Celia both, I really appreciate you putting yourself out there like that and having this, like, forever available in the Ethernet and everything else. And I really understand the weight of this on so many levels, and I just really appreciate you being so forthright. I also want to say that I was at the Albany screening of it, and the Mental Health Empowerment Project had about at least 150 people. I think
wow.
They had 165 people. It was almost every single seat in the place was taken.
Wow.
And what it did is it started a conversation, and I think we have a lot to talk about.
Yes.
And yeah. I don't want to detract from what it is right now to talk about all of that, but I'm going to suggest that maybe we can do future shows and really start to pull apart, like, what are some of the issues inside of this.
And then on the other side, how
did they do it, and how do we keep on doing it? Because there's this thing that, especially, I really liked what you were talking about, Jen, in terms of how, I think it was, you said PJ went around training people in how to take video, edit video, all of this kind of stuff, and to have ownership over it. And I think that that's something that is missing in some stuff that I've done up until this point and would really like to add in as we move forward.
Wow, that's great.
But it's,
I think that's good too. And one thing is, Celia, I need to find a way of mailing to you. There's a video that was done, a video diary that St. Elizabeth sent to people, because we need to share our stories, even though it seems like it's gone out of fashion. But our stories are very important for people to hear.
Right. And you know what struck me just briefly, we don't have to get it on the discussion, but some young people, I was kind of shocked, but I sat with it, were happy to identify with the diagnosis of bipolar or whatever, and that helped them. And another young person said, well, the diagnosis didn't define her. And, you know, usually at these things I get upset, but I didn't. I just felt like, oh, well, this is what they really think about who they are. And what do we do with that now, knowing everything that we know and all of the alternatives and everything that the system is doing? We still have people out there that are not buying into what the system is offering. So I'm wondering how we change the conversation.
What happens is they get upset. As I was talking to someone who is younger than me today, what happens is you wake up and you're upset. I got the information. You're upset because you did not know this. And that's the thing that upsets people, because they did not know that there was a
no. This person knew. She looked at it, and for her personal, in her personal experience, she identified with the diagnosis, and that's what helped her.
I understand them. That I was a person who identified too, because what happens is you have all these things happening to you, and all of a sudden people tell you, "Oh, it's because you're this diagnosis." So that gives you comfort. The only problem is that it does not help you move forward. That's what I'm saying. So
no, I believe it. I mean, I was acting like Oprah at this thing and just taking the mic around and let people say their piece. So I didn't really even comment on anything. It's just still a division of, and this has been going on for years, but I think the way that Oryx and TJ did this film is that they put the issues out there in a way that people could hear it, even so some people may not agree with it, you know?
Well, Cecilia, this is what I say, is this. I don't have psychiatric symptoms anymore. They threaten me with diabetes. And in fact, I tell people just recently, I was telling someone, my AC1 was 5.7 on a Friday. They sent me home and asked me to take a picture of everything I ate and to bring it back that Monday, because they couldn't believe it, that I had gotten to a point where I had taken care of it. They couldn't believe. I had a psychiatrist that said, well, you know what you're doing. That's not a antidepressant. That's not a mood stabilizer.
And well, I don't want to get totally. I just want to tell you that the conversation, as Lauren was saying, needs to continue.
The conversation needs to continue. But what I'm saying is that some people, they will say that because it's I know why I'm having this difficulty. But at the same time, what I'm saying is people can find solutions to that.
Right.
And what happens is when you get to be X number of years old, you get upset because you say, why didn't I know this? Why didn't I know this before I gained 60 pounds, before I got diabetes, before I had fog and I couldn't work and have a meaningful work experience? That's
right.
All I'm saying.
Okay, but I'm just saying that some people think what you just said, and others are sticking to the diagnosis. That's all I'm saying.
That has
not evolved because they watched the film Friday night, you know?
They need informed. Go ahead, Jen.
Oh, hey, thanks. Yeah, I'd like to speak to this just a little bit if I could as well, if you guys are all right with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I live in a state where 100% of the funds go to the traditional system. And that's either community mental health centers or the state hospital. And so I hear what you heard after the film a lot, Celia. And I want to just speak to a couple of those issues. One is, I think that before I had a diagnosis and before a lot of these folks have a diagnosis, we're still living with things, whether they're labeled symptoms or not, that are really, really hard to live with. We're still kind of out of sync a lot of the times with the people around us. Life is really hard. And so a couple of great things about diagnosis are we find out that we're not the only ones, and then there's a community of people like that. And it also makes things a little easier because we have a way to explain ourselves that kind of excuses who we are as people. And I hate to say it like that, and it breaks my heart to hear people talk about themselves like they're a diagnosis, especially because a lot of times it's apology after apology. It's, I'm sorry, my bipolar. I'm sorry, my bipolar. But we're taught that. And it does make life a little easier to have a reason for that. And so I get when people are in that place, and I was in that place for a long time, and it's a great repose. I don't know if that's the right word, from just being out there and being different and being wrong and being upsetting to other people. It's nice to be able to say, yeah, but this, I'm like this 'cause my brain is broken. And so you need to make space for me because my brain is broken and that's not my fault. And not that I think that the issues that people that get labeled have are their fault. I think as a society, we've created this place where we have a lot of people that are really struggling to try to live a very hard life because the expectations of who you should be are so difficult and narrow if you have a depth of experience, if you've lived a lot of life. So that's the first thing. And so I think I try to be as welcoming as possible with folks like that and to not try to force movement or force change on that individual, but just to be okay with that. And hopefully people become over time more interested in the idea of being who they're meant to be. And also hopefully over time, we as a society learn how to bring people into the fold more without a diagnosis. The other piece of that is I spent a lot of years in that system with heavy labels, SED as a kid, and then with severe and persistent mental illness. Now it's serious mental illness. And I was taught to fear going out in the community, taught to fear trying. And even for years when I just got released from that system, which never happens because my awesome case manager at the mental health center decided that that what they were offering wasn't a help to me, and that the things that I was finding on my own for ways to support myself and navigate my way through madness and how to live were working for me. Up until that point, when I was released, maybe I don't even think it's been 2 years that I was released out of that system. It was all about preparing for the next big fail. And I was definitely taught to fear trying, especially when I was heavily doped and medicated, and also to fear the community. It's hard for us to get people to come to our events that are that are in the system because we're doing things that are outside the mental health center. And that community mental health center is labeled as something wonderful because we're out in the community, but we're really trapped in fear. And the providers fear us going out on their own. They were terrified when I helped start this first peer-run support group in South Dakota because there's no provider going to be there on the weekend, and we're going to hurt each other, which didn't happen at all. But we're taught to fear going out and doing anything on our own, even making our own grocery list or preparing our own budget. It's like have your case manager help you with everything. And it's okay that you don't contribute to your community. You're not meant to. We'll get you signed up for all your benefits, and we'll put you over here in this mental health center, and you'll have friends here at the mental health center, and you come to the drop-in and with your ticket, and you can get your dollar lunch, and this is your life now. And people very rarely get out of that. That system is just it ends in a brick wall. That's what people are up against when they go to see a film like this.
It's a horrible existence that, you know, that you just go to a place where and other people are making money off of you. And I want to tell people again that we're at 267-521-0167. Our lines are open, 267-521-0167.
It is a horrible place, just real quick. It's also better than, for a lot of folks, it's better than living on the street. It's better than being completely isolated and alone. If I have a case manager that's paid to talk to me every week, paid to come by and visit me, I've like built a built-in social structure that I don't have otherwise. So what are we as a society doing that there's so many people that are isolated and alone and or living on the street? What can we all do differently?
I'm isolated where I live because we got people that they just prefer to be with other people who are making money or peer specialists. They don't care about people that are on the backs who help them to get to the point that they're in. Area code 707, area code 310 if you want to come in, and area code 202 if you want to come in. Their lines are open now. I just want to make sure that if people want to come in, that they can come in to the network so they can comment or ask questions. A lot of times people they want to just listen, but we want to make sure that if people do want to come in and comment that they can do that. So if you are, the lines are open, so if you do want to come in, you can come in at this time. I'm sorry, Jen. I wanted to make sure that you completed your thought about the mental health system.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting. I can't hold it in sometimes. So
I interrupted.
I think that one of the things is over time it shifts, and over time I think personally I came to understand clearly that anything that it had to offer was not going to be beneficial in any kind of way, and anything that felt like any kind of social system. This social thing was really a structured payment operation that was occurring. And I think that, Celia, what you were saying about the young people, I get so concerned sometimes because it's a different kind of thing even than I think what you're describing, Yvonne, but I think that that happens always. But I've gotten kids
already,
just to give...
They already know... And they waste time. I just say
No. I mean, what I'm talking about is something very different. I'm talking about young people who have been brought up from birth that there is nothing wrong with this, that that this is who they are, that they should hold on to this, that this is their identity,
mm-hmm.
and that a result of the quote-unquote anti-stigma programming, and people who and young people, and I've gotten kicked out of chat rooms for suggesting that, you know, that this was a fraud. You know, that I was quote unquote abusing people and hurting people by suggesting such a thing. So I think that it's really with the next generations coming up, I think that we're really in an additional fight. I don't think the other fights have gone away, and I think what you've described is absolutely accurate. But for these young people, Celia, I think that this is what you're talking about, or I don't know, maybe it's something totally
different.
Yeah,
I am talking about it. It was distressing, and I just kind of, you know, listened and shut down a little bit. I mean, I didn't comment on it. I just let everybody have their voice, you know, as we do, but it was disturbing.
It's and I think over time it hopefully will evolve, and so, you know, but you planted a seed, Celia, and even if right now there's a real opposition to it, because it cuts at everything that they've been built their lives around, it's still a seed that's been planted by the whole movie and by the whole discussion and about giving them a voice to be able to say what they want, and I think that that's really.
What was the response, Celia?
Everyone had a different response. Go ahead, Lauren.
I'm just going to put myself on again for. I can go back to just, you know, being like behind the scenes and not being a call-in, but I can't help myself sometimes. I want to underscore that, again, I don't want to take anything away from anything. I think it's great that this is going on. I know how hard this is to do. I think it's phenomenal that so many people were involved and supported it and everything else. Not saying anything like that. But one of the several things that came up at the Albany discussion, which I think are just really important to underscore, that the panelists brought up, were the lack of diversity, the seeming to be largely white male privilege that may be still operating in certain places, economics, not discussing poverty, not getting into these things in a deeper level, not really looking at rape or sexual assault in those kinds of deeper terms of things that we need to still have conversations about, prison psychiatry. These were all things that came up in from the presenters, and I think it's really important for people to broaden that conversation out, that, you know, this was a phenomenal effort, national effort, international effort probably, to get everybody focusing on things. And now that we have, how do we get deeper into these really pressing issues and the issues of society and how they wind up playing themselves out over and over again inside of the psychiatry?
Yes.
I agree with Lauren. And I also agree with you, too.
All right, I'm going away. Bye.
I totally wholeheartedly agree with Lauren, and also recognize what these guys were able to accomplish in 90 minutes. And there were a lot of scenes that would have added to that likely, that were cut from the film and not cut forever. But really what these guys had to look at was, how do we create an engaging film of 90 minutes that starts the conversation? And so I think there definitely can and should be space for this to move forward to deeper levels and to maybe more films, definitely to more conversations around a lot of those issues. And if you look at what can a filmmaker do in 90 minutes to really get this conversation started and to move people, I think that's what these guys were really looking at to start with. And I feel like this isn't something that they made a film and they're done with it. These guys are really committed to continuing to move the conversation forward well beyond this film. And so absolutely, I think that those are certainly criticisms. And I recognize that there was a lot of thought that put into How do we maximize what we can do with this film, and how do we make it engaging and entertaining, and how do we have it follow some sort of kind of story arc all the way through without it being 5.5 hours long? I think they have to look at.
One of the things I say is when you see these crowd financing campaigns, whether they be Kickstarter or GoFundMe, is that we need to get involved because it does take a certain amount of cash to bring them to the film. So if you really have criticism about it and you say, why isn't this happening, is that we need to start participating, whether it's at the $10, $15, or $20 level, is that you need to respond and to vote your dollars where your mouth is, because there's no film person that's producing stuff about us. We are producing it ourselves, and you've got to be able to do that. You know, you got to be able to do this, to say, this is what I want to say, or this is what I think should be said, and let me support them in what they're doing. And I'm just saying that that's what we got to do. And we do have all of our lines open, including 617-707-310-571-202. So if you want to come in, you can come in and call. We've got another about 15 minutes of show. So if you have comments or questions, please feel free to call in at this particular time. And I would say that I'm at the point of the show right now. The show goes for 2 hours, but I'm at the point to ask Jen. And to you, if you have any other comments to close up. So if you are listening and you want to comment in, please press 1 or star 1 so that the lines will be opened up so you can talk, because it's time for us to end the show.
Okay.
And on future shows, we will say how you can find out more information about the Healing Voices. Anyone want to come in now?
Julie Green.
Go ahead. Hi,
Julie Green, can you hear me? Hello? No?
Where area code are you calling from?
This is Julie Green, can you hear me?
No. What area code are you calling from?
I don't know if you have me unmuted. This is Julie Green. I'm calling from 617.
Hi, Julie. This is Celia. I'm going to respond to your email as a side
note. You can hear me. Okay.
Thank you. Well, we have so many people on, it's difficult, so that's why I was asking you what area code you come. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I didn't even know your show was on until just now, and I've just called in. Some people aren't on Facebook, and that's why I just didn't know. It would be nice if there was some way that these Blog Talk Radio shows would be announced, say, a day ahead of time instead of 120 minutes ahead of time. Just some feedback. Because
okay.
I don't check my email every 5 minutes, so I never find out until, say, the show is almost over or the show is already gone and passed. I rarely find out about the shows on time unless I've been told that the shows are happening. And I'm looking for just about all of them. It would be really nice to know ahead of time. If there's some way that you can announce them, say, a week ahead of time or a few days ahead of time instead of 120 minutes ahead of time, which is just 2 hours. It's not enough warning time. Thank you.
Duly noted, and it will be done. Duly
right,
noted
and Julie, I'll figure out a way to send it to the Mind Freedom list. Because you're right, there's not a lot of people we think everyone's on Facebook. I think it too, but really not a lot of people are on, and they do look at their emails.
We will do better. We will do better. Thank you for your comments, and we will do better.
Can I make a statement really quick? I think that it's usually a weekly Sunday night show that Yvonne does at 9 p.m. Eastern, and my shows have been really hit and miss lately, so I also will try to be better about that. But I do want to just remind people that we are at 2,414 people who support the petition to the FDA to stop the shock device from getting down classified. As soon as we hit 2,500, I'm sending it all to them. They're publishing about 30 comments a day of the over 600 comments that we were able to post to the site. Everybody knows who we are. They've stopped taking our calls. And so people need to be prepared that within a couple of days or a couple of months, depending on how they do it, that the FDA is going to come out with a decision, and we are going to need to act one way or the other if it's hopefully a celebration, but if not, it may take a little bit more organizing. So for people to be prepared that that's coming down the pike, we only need, I think, 86 people as of right now to get to 2,500. So if you're listening, go to change.org and sign the FDA, stop the FDA from down-classifying the shock device to a Class 2 device stop shock treatment petition. And, we've gotten two more people since the show started, so now we only need 84 people. So that's it. And also the FDA to go comment on the electric skin device shocking machine. They're actually planning on banning that, ironically, because they say that labels aren't sufficient to mitigate the risk, which I don't know why labels are sufficient to mitigate the risk in shock treatment, since it's the same thing, electricity being used in order to punish somebody and hurt them. Anyway, okay, that's my thing. And thank you to everybody who's been supportive.
And I want to ask people if they're interested in it. I don't know whether there's an interest or not, but I found there are certain ways in which we could have actual live video. I don't know if blog radio is the best way to do it, but coming up for the future, if you feel as though you prefer to see people or have people see you, there are ways in which we could do that as well. So if you will let us know that if that is your preference, if you prefer to have streaming, if we could have Lauren, myself, and other people live and picturesque, if that's the thing. I don't think that that is what most people want, but if that is what you prefer, there are ways in which we could do that as well. So it is 10:44, and we have about 15 minutes before the show actually ends, and I would just say that if you would take the link to the show and share it with your other friends so that they would know, and all of our shows are backed up on the blog radio. Lauren is the producer of the show, and she has let me use this time slot. Sometimes people don't agree with it, what we have on the show, but we're for Late Night with a Hero. Our shows are to inform people, whether it's maybe not necessarily the person that you are not interested in hearing from, but they may have a message to show you. And I want to comment to people that the Murphy Bill is still alive and well, and that you should pay attention to that with your congresspeople. There is still an election going on at this time. There is a congressional election. All of your congresspeople for the next two years, they have to come up and be recertified as your congressperson. The U.S. Senate, there are some senators who are up to be reelected, and that you want to pay attention to that and look at H.R. 2646, which will certainly devastate our community as far as taking away our rights and freedoms that we have. So there are a lot of things that you might want to pay attention to on blog radio, on Late Night with a Hero, and on Lauren Tenney's show. So please pay attention, and we will try to do a much better job of making sure that the information is available when we're there. I try not to have shows unless there's something important for us to impart on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock p.m. If anyone else has anything else to say before we sign off, please do this at this time. It is 10:47 p.m. on Eastern Standard Time.
I just wanted to thank you, Yvonne, for this show and for me to be able to come on to talk about Healing Voices and other issues. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank Lauren for allowing me to have this Sunday night slot. We don't all of the time have shows, but we're in a very devastating time at this time in our history that we need to pay attention, be able to contact our congresspeople and senators and to tell them how we feel about H.R. 2646 and other measures. And I would suggest that people also, if they're not a member of Mind Freedom, if they become a member of Mind Freedom, and if they are
Thank
a member
you.
Already, to give a donation to Mind Freedom, because Mind Freedom is the only organization that's standing pat for our rights at this particular time. I mean, there are other organizations who say they're doing this. I'm not saying that they're not, but this is an open organization that is standing up and standing for our rights, and we're in a perilous time. We're almost in a time almost similar to Germany in the 1930s, and I know some people may disagree with me, but that's the way it is. Thank you very much, and have a good night to everyone.
Okay, you too, Yvonne, and bye, Lauren, Jen, and Julie, and everyone out there.
Have a good night. It's
okay. Bye.
10:48, and it's time for us to sign off.
Thanks, all. Good night.